There are so many roads, and each is fit for that one pilgrim who must follow it. How can a spider or a tiny ant tread the same path as some huge elephant? Each pilgrim's progress is commensurate with his specific qualities and state. No matter how it strives, what gnat could fly as swiftly as the winds that scour the sky? Our pathways differ. No bird ever knows the secret route by which another goes. Our insight comes to us by different signs, one prays in mosques and one in idols' shrines. But when truth's sunlight clears the upper air, each pilgrim sees that he's welcomed there.
Holy, oh, oh, holy, oh, oh, holy, oh, oh, oh.
Hello and welcome once again to the Spouter Inn. I'm Chris.
And I'm Suzanne.
And this time we are reading Attar's The Conference of the Birds.
Yes, it's the first part of our next cluster on animals.
Yes. This was my first time reading this poem. I believe you've read it before.
I've read it a number of times, sometimes just in an excerpted kind of way, and I've taught it a couple of times as well. So I wouldn't say I know it like incredibly, incredibly well, but it's a familiar friend.
What courses were you teaching it in?
Well, the first time actually I taught it was in a directed reading that was for somebody who was a grad student at the time who wanted to sort of go through Orientalist translation, that is translations into English of, you know, Oriental, like Orientalist kinds of approaches to Persian and Arabic literature. So we read Burton's translation of the Arabian Nights. We read translations of Attar along with Fitzgerald's translation of Omar Khayyam and so on. So it was about thinking about Western reception, right, of quote unquote Oriental texts. And then I read it on its own just to sort of have a sense of how it was relating to that. And then I excerpted a part of it for the Norton Anthology of World Literature. So then I was thinking about how would you teach this? And then taught it a couple times in a sort of global Middle Ages survey. So different kinds of contexts. And so I feel like I kind of know it in pieces, like I've mined it for different things over time. So actually this was the first time I'd read it where I was just reading it just for itself.
Did you enjoy it?
I find it hard, but not in an unpleasant way. Like I find it to be a book that I notice different things in at different times. Like this time reading it, I was noticing the passages about Joseph, the biblical Joseph a lot, right? Which I'd noticed before, but I was kind of responding to them this time. And I do think it's a book that asks you to read that way. Like it asks you to read in a reflective, I don't know, maybe even contemplative kind of way. And so I think it could be alienating for some readers, but very attractive for others.
Yeah, that was definitely some of the experience I had with it, reading it for the first time. It's a book that assumes that you have a certain cultural knowledge, which I don't, because I don't share the exact same set of stories and myths and so forth that its original readers would have had. And it's also a book that is taking you on a religious journey. It is a guidebook for certain religious aims, and I am not personally necessarily interested in arriving at the aims that this book wants me to arrive at. Nevertheless, there was still quite a lot. And I walked away from the book having enjoyed a lot about it and also thinking, yeah, this is a book that really does want me to read it and think about it and would reward reading it and rereading it and thinking more about it. Even if I wasn't trying to read it for the religious aims, it still would probably be quite rewarding to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Struck by two things you said. One is you said that like the kind of the cultural reference here, like the stories that are alluded to, some of them would be unfamiliar to a reader who wasn't familiar with either Islamic tradition or Persian literature. And that's true for a number of them, like Layli and Majnun or the Sufi mystic Halaj, like things like this would be unfamiliar. But some of them are probably widely familiar, like Alexander the Great shows up, or I mentioned Joseph, or Jesus shows up, and Socrates, right? It inhabits a funny kind of ground of strangeness and familiarity, because even the familiar figures like Joseph, like it's the Quran's Joseph, as opposed to the Joseph of Genesis. So that's kind of interesting.
Exactly. Jesus shows up and there's some story about him that I had to look to the footnotes for. And even then I was like, I don't fully understand what this story is doing. And it's nothing like I'm familiar with, but
yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's that. And then the one other thing you mentioned too, is that, you know, it expects a reader that either is devout or is interested in devotion, like one or both of those things. And I do find theology really interesting, as you know, and particularly what's sometimes called apophatic or negative theology. That is a theology that's about annihilation of the self. I find that super interesting, whether we're talking about medieval Western literature, like Marguerite Porret or something like that, or Islamic or other religious traditions that have that kind of theology. So that's one of the things that definitely appeals to me.
Well, I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about that more in a little bit. But first, let's get a little bit more background on the text. Now, I am turning to you like the birds in this text turn to the hoopoe to be their guide, because you are much more familiar both with the text and with the history behind the text. So can you give us, please, a little bit of background behind Attar, the author?
Yeah, we don't know a huge amount about him, but I can say a little bit about what we do know. He lived in the 12th into the early 13th century. We know he died sometime around the siege of Nishapur in 1221, which is a sort of a catastrophic event that destroyed this city that was known for its luxuriousness and incredible learning. It was a real repository of books and all commentary traditions and things like this, and was destroyed by invaders in 1221. So we know he died around that time. There's various myths that tell the story of his death in ways that probably embellish the truth. But so that's something we can anchor. And his tomb is still there. His name, Attar, means pharmacist or druggist. So he's clearly someone who works in medicine in an applied way. In other words, there's people who are physicians in that period, but who are working in a more abstract kind of theoretical way about the body. And he's somebody who's, applying medicines. And the reason I mention that, and I find it kind of interesting, is because his books are so relentlessly concerned with the spiritual and sometimes almost spiritual medicines or spiritual restoration, health and illness feature a lot, but they're understood in a metaphysical way. So I find that aspect of his biography kind of interesting. So a lot of works are attributed to him, like about 40 works, but two of them are definitely by him. And one of them is The Conference of the Birds, and another one is called The Biographies of the Saints. And when we hear saints, we kind of think, many people think the Christian idea of saints, but here saints is referring to Sufi pious people, devout practitioners and exemplars, like models for others in Muslim religious practice. And Sufism, I won't say a lot about it, but it's just a particular mode of devotion that is found in both Shia and Sunni, so different theologically oriented Muslim communities. And you can think about it in terms of theory and in terms of practice. And the Sufi saints, that is the noteworthy Sufis, kind of distinguish themselves in one or both of those realms. In terms of theory, their theology, as I mentioned before, apophatic. It's about annihilation. The goal of your mystical journey is to annihilate the self, like to lose yourself in the other, in God, right, in the divine. Like the one metaphor that gets used a lot in Attar is the drop that goes to the sea and is dissolved into the ocean, right? That's the goal, the spiritual goal. And this is not specifically Muslim. You find this in other traditions. But in terms of practice, Sufism is a faith that involves devotion to one's friends, by which I mean those who are in the Sufi community. So these are fellow travelers. These are people who are also seeking dissolution in the divine. And you'll see the language, and we have it here in the Conference of the Birds, the references to the friend. And that's a way of referring to God. And it's a way of bringing out the mutuality of the devotion of the lover and the beloved, the self and God. Like it's not a one-way street. It's always two-way. So even as you are rushing toward God in this devotional model, he's also rushing toward you. So it's kind of neat. Desire and longing are incredibly important in this kind of theology. And that's why love and even eroticism are all over the Conference of the Birds. And there's this one anecdote that I just want to mention in connection with Attar's biography that I find so interesting. It's associated with the Sufi mystic Halaj. Attar tells a story of Halaj. He's outstanding for having been a martyr to his faith. But the story I want to tell is this one. He's supposed to have said that the angel Iblis, who's kind of a figure like Lucifer, had disobeyed God's command made at the time of the creation of mankind, where God supposedly said to the angels that they should bow down to Adam. And Iblis doesn't do it. He disobeys God's command. But he's done it for the best of reasons, because Iblis knows that God's greatest desire is that only he should be bowed down to and worshipped. So he puts God's desire ahead of God's command. And that weird priority informs all of Sufi theology, this idea that desire is the thing that comes first. And even if it means breaking the commands that you get from your religious law, that doesn't matter as long as you're serving this desire. And you see that all over the Conference of the Birds.
Yeah. Oh, boy, there's a lot in that.
There's a lot in it. But that's the background, and this layered quality of the text where you can go back and read it again and again, it invites contemplative reading. And so you could see how it would be really appealing to people who are within those kinds of religious communities, as well as beyond nowadays.
Yeah. No, absolutely. A little bit about what happens in the book itself, although not much happens.
Not a lot of plot.
There is a through line. We've got birds. The birds are sort of, well, first off, we should say there's a prologue and an epilogue to the text. And They're not always translated in every edition. They're not always read. They are very much separate from the main text, even though they do travel with it and offer some reflection on it. The prologue is mostly about God, and the epilogue is mostly about Attar. Mm-hmm. But ignoring that for a moment, we begin with a hailing of all the different birds who have gathered, starting with the hoopoe, who is going to be our main bird throughout the book. They all gather together, and they're looking for guidance. They're looking for a ruler. And the hoopoe tells them about the Simorgh. I seem to recall that the Simorgh is from China?
Well, he shows up as a kind of a mythic bird creature in Ferdowsi Shahnameh and sort of Persian myth broadly. He's from beyond Kaf's mountain peak, which is the most distant mountain imaginable, Mount Kaf. It's a way of a geographical location to describe as far as you could possibly go.
Right. And I think that's sort of what China is also doing here. But yeah, as the text says, it was in China late one moonless night, the Simorgh first appeared to mortal sight. And in China, you can still see a feather of his. Whence comes the saying you've heard, no doubt, seek knowledge unto China, seek it out, which may refer to actual China, but also I think has that sense of it's very far.
Yeah, it's a hadith, that line, seek knowledge unto China. The idea being that knowledge is so precious that even if you have to go to the end of the earth to get it, that's what you do. And so this idea of the end of the earth is what the Simorgh is being associated with.
Yeah. And so, of course, the birds then decide that they're going to go to the end of the earth to seek out this Simorgh, this prized, wonderful thing. But the birds are a little bit hesitant. Each one has a different reason why maybe this isn't a good idea for them. And they present the hoopoe with their problems. And the hoopoe gives them, you know, reasons why maybe their fears are unfounded or founded in some cases, but they should still go anyways if they can.
It's really neatly structured, that part, you know, where you get each bird in according to its kind, like they go in by like order of creation kind of. The bird tells its story, the hoopoe answers, and then there's a story. So it's like bird, hoopoe, story, bird, hoopoe, story. It's pretty tightly structured on the outset.
Absolutely. Then after that, and after a particularly long story, which we might talk about, they decide, okay, the hoopoe, you're going to lead us to it. And then the hoopoe describes what's going to come next, which is the seven valleys. Mm-hmm. And these valleys are intense, but they're the seven different stages of this road to enlightenment's maybe not quite the right word, but this road to self-destruction, in a sense, this road to being absorbed into the divine.
Both of those, right? I mean, that's exactly it. You know, like being melted in the ocean, burned up in the sun, right? It's a kind of enlightenment, right?
Yeah. It's very intense. And in fact, as they go on, some of them are quite terrifying sounding. Those are some of the most interesting sections of the book, I thought. Then after having described the seven metaphorical valleys, they actually set off. And in a very quick chapter, they go off. Some of the birds actually just say, no, I'm tapping out. This is not good for me. And then they say, the conditions are so harsh. It's so difficult to make this journey that only one in every 100,000 make it. And in fact, only 30 birds finally arrive. They ask after the Simorgh. They don't fear what the final consequences are of encountering it is. And they see it. And it was them all along? And then, so Simorgh, I guess, is a translation of a word that means 30 birds, if I understand this correctly.
In Farsi, si means 30, and morgh is bird.
Right.
So there's this word, the Simorgh, which is in myth. Like, it's actually a mythic thing, but it plays on this pun of the word. And so they get to the end, and they see the Simorgh. At themselves, they stare and see a second Simorgh standing there. They look at both and see the two are one. And right, so it's this weird moment of recognition that it's actually them all along.
And then they stop existing.
Yeah, well.
Which is what they were trying to do anyways at this point. So that's a happy ending. And then there are a few more stories after that, and then you get the epilogue. And I should say also, during the Seven Valleys, as they're describing each valley, then there are also even more parables and more stories to go along with them. And you're meant to associate all of these stories to the particular trials of the various valleys.
And certain figures will show up in different parables within different valleys or at different moments of the narrative.
Yeah, definitely. There were some people who I didn't know when I first started reading this, but I encountered them along the way several times, and I grew to know them a little bit, and some of them seemed quite interesting. But it is true that, like, there is more parable than there is bird narrative, let's say.
Oh, there's tons of parable.
Yeah. And that's really, in a sense, what you're coming to this book for, is the bird story is just this skeleton frame of it's a structure. It's a nothing of a structure, in a sense, but it is the structure for how you might think about your own journey to this final state. And then all of these very compact, very, it seems, based on the translation that we were looking at, very well-told stories, very efficiently told stories, are little kernels of further thinking that you can dive into. And it's that act of really unpacking the stories that I think gets this book the attention that it has gotten.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. You're right that the birds are kind of, they form a kind of skeleton for the work as a whole. They're almost peripheral, by which I mean they're there and they speak and they have concerns and they make the journey, but they don't really engage in an analytical kind of way in the reception of the parables. Like, we as the readers are engaging and receiving these parables and being put into different sort of affective states by them, I think, even. So the birds are like curiously there and yet in the background always in some kind of sense, which I find kind of interesting. The other thing I think the birds are there for is to make us think about unity and multiplicity. Like, you know, we've all seen bird flocks, and I'm thinking especially of murmurations. You know what those are, right? It's where birds are flying in a flock and it makes this kind of shape as they move. Like it's quite, I don't know, unnerving sometimes, you know, because they seem to be one organism.
Exactly.
Right? And it's kind of beautiful and terrifying at the same time. And I feel like the birds here in the Conference of Birds are functioning in this kind of way because they're each individuals. We get a lot of emphasis on their individuality in that opening section. Like we're encouraged to think about them as individuals in that opening section. But in fact, as we discover at the end, they're one, right? They're the Seamorg. And their lack of personality is kind of helpful, I think, to that process. And so we're being encouraged to think about that. And the reason I think that's so important is because otherwise the work is very, very, very binary in its understanding of lover and beloved, soul and God, and all these pairs. Like it's a book that's full of pairs. So the birds are the one thing that kind of stands outside of that to some extent.
Yeah, we'll have to think about that a bit more, or I'll have to think about that a bit more. I agree, and that the birds also play this interesting thing where, as we said, the very first section, the first several pages of the book are hailing each bird individually and talking about what its specific characteristics are. And then you get the section where the birds are all making individual excuses for it, which don't feel 100% tied to the individual bird, but, you know, maybe they are still out there. And then when you get to the valleys, there's no birds. Like, the hoopoe is talking, but there's no individual birds doing anything. And even by the end, like, although we assume the hoopoe who's been talking to us made it to be part of the 30 birds of the Seamorg, I don't know if we actually get told that. Like,
I think you're right. I don't think that's clear, which is really interesting, right?
All individuality of different kinds of birds is gone by the end of the book, and it erodes faithfully throughout the book.
It's exactly right. I mean, we're really encouraged to think about them as individuals at the outset. You know, we've got the nightingale, the parrot, the peacock. You know, there's this real, the duck, right? We've really got a strong sense of kinds, that is species, right? One after another, and really having that pulled apart. But that will get gradually broken down through the whole work until finally they're just one thing. And you don't even know what individuality might still remain. Like you said, the hoopoe, we don't even know if the hoopoe is still there or not. So the question of a leader, which was so important at the beginning, like, has become irrelevant.
Yeah. The leader has done their job.
That's it. They're there.
Yeah. It's interesting also because, like, I've read other animal parables, even other medieval animal parables, and I've never seen that happen before.
No.
I've never seen the animality fade away and not replaced with humanity, not replaced with more human-like traits, but replaced with nothingness.
That's actually a really neat point. I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right. I was thinking earlier today about like other animal texts that we're not doing, like thinking about animal allegories, like, I don't know, Animal Farm and things like this, right? And there the animals stay doing their animaling all the way through, right? But this dissolution thing, I've never seen that anywhere else.
We should take a second to talk about the translations. The main one that we're looking at was done by Dick Davis and Afkam Darbandi, who are a husband and wife team who did this translation, most of it in the 80s. There's a revised version that came out in 2011. And then we're also looking at an even newer translation by the poet Shola Wolpe. And they're very different translations.
Yeah. How would you characterize them? Like, I mean, I have a sense of what I think about it, but what's your perspective on them?
Well, there's a few different things going on, I guess. Dick Davis is a bit more of a traditionalist in his own poetry. He's a new formalist, it's called. He's not interested in free verse. And so he looks to Dryden, of all people, as a model for how to deal with the rhyming couplets of the original Persian. So you get rhyming couplets in English, and it's a little bit old-fashioned reading, but he's very good at it. And in the introduction, he's got a very interesting description about sort of why this is a good verse for it, because it's sort of there in the background as a verse form, and it keeps a certain structure and a certain pace, but it's not too poetic all the time, because that can really wear you down, and this isn't that kind of text. This isn't the Aeneid, let's say.
Yeah. No, it's kind of neat, too, because the verse form of the Masnavi is, if you're saying it's couplets, and it kind of is, but what it is, it's actually one long line that has two parts.
Right,
And the reason I think that's worth noticing is interesting is because, you know, we're talking about the sort of binarism of this poem, you know, like that it's really interested in pairs of things. Right? And the multiplicity of the birds is the one exception to that, I think. And so the verse form really brings that out. And I think that's one of the reasons why Davis and Darbandi are so interested in maintaining that pairing function, right? In a way that Wolpe is not going to do because she's interested in doing something a bit different.
Yeah. So Wolpe is trying to put it into a very contemporary verse form. And she translates a lot of the parables into prose in a sense to I got the sense from her introduction that it was to sort of push it into a new register.
Which is an interesting choice.
Which is an interesting choice. And in a sense, what she's trying to do is make this text function for the reader the way that the original text was meant to function for its readers. So she is translating it to be a kind of spiritual guide first and foremost, I think. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that Davis is translating it to be a literary text.
I think that's a good comparison, yeah.
So perhaps because I am more interested in this as a literary text, the Dick Davis translation did more for me. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think if I had to choose one of the two, I would choose that too. But Wolpe is worth a look.
It definitely was interesting to have both of them side by side.
I liked Wolpe's intro too. I thought it was quite interesting. She brings out some things about the Masnavi form that we were just talking about. And also she draws our attention to something that I wasn't thinking about consciously, but of course it's super interesting. The fact that you don't have grammatical gender in Farsi. Like you don't have like you don't distinguish he, she, and like you don't have gendered nouns the way you do in like, I don't know, French or German. And that has an interesting effect in a text like this where the binarism of gender is really important to the symbolic system of the work as a whole.
Yeah, she points out that she doesn't give gender assignments to the birds in particular because
you can't,
it makes no sense in many levels, but also because by the time you get to the end of this spiritual journey, gender is obliterated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So yeah, that is interesting. And certainly, you know, introductions are always great. Read all the introductions you can, even if you don't read the entire translations. We talked a little bit about how there are certain figures who show up again and again and again in this book. A few of them, as I said, caught my eye. I'm wondering if any in particular caught your eye. You mentioned Joseph as one of them.
Yeah, I find him, he appears in here a number of times. And I said before, he's sort of the Joseph of the Quran as opposed to the Joseph of Genesis. And those are not mutually exclusive, but the kind of focus and emphasis you get in the story of Yusuf in the Quran is a little bit different. And here in Attar's poem, we hear Joseph brought to light, or is evoked in terms of the object of desire. Really frequently. So there's references to him getting lost and imprisoned in the well and his brothers and his father seeking him out and things like this. And he also gets mentioned in connection with the desire of Pharaoh's wife, Zuleika, for him. So he's this object of desire, but in different kinds of ways. And it's interesting to think about that in terms of that dynamic of the soul and the divine, because that's the allegory that's being invoked by Joseph. But there's so many other figures as well.
Well, why don't you unpack a little bit more about what's going on with Joseph there?
Okay. Yeah, well, so a really great way of getting at the way the Joseph story is working is not actually in one of the little Joseph stories that shows up in Attar's Conference of the Birds, but in a reference to Joseph that comes at the tail end of another little story that is one of the tellings of the Layla and Majnun story. And anybody who's ever listened to Eric Clapton's Layla kind of knows this story, right? It's basically, it's this beautiful story that gets retold by a number of different writers in Persia. Nizami's version is the most famous one, I think. Basically, Majnun falls in love with Layli, but he loses his mind, right? And he's sort of driven to madness by his love and desire. And it all ends up very tragically. It's like a kind of a remarkable story. But anyway, so we get some evocations of the Layla and Majnun story. And in one of them, Joseph shows up in a really neat kind of way, almost as a punctuation. So I'm going to read a few lines. Once someone saw Majnun oppressed with pain, sifting the dusty highway grain by grain, and asked, "What are you searching for, my friend?" He cried, "My search for Layli has no end." The man protested, "Layli is a girl, and dust will not conceal this precious pearl." Majnun replied, "I search in every place. Who knows where I may glimpse her lovely face?" Yusuf of Hamadan, a learned seer, once said, "Above, below, in every sphere, each atom is a Jacob, fervently searching for Joseph throughout eternity." And then a little later in another story, there's a description of another beloved, a very beautiful woman. She seemed a Joseph, and her dimpled skin, the well that lovely youth was hidden in. So you get these evocations of sort of lover and beloved scenes, and then Joseph appears almost as a kind of, I don't know, a code word or like an epitome, like a way to describe the beloved who is hidden away or trapped or inaccessible, that if you could only get at, something wonderful would happen. But then the stories of Joseph also include, you know, the accounts of him, his time in Egypt, and he rises to a position of prominence, and he's able to then confer gifts on his brothers who had betrayed him and on his father. So all the different guises in which the friend, capital F, right, shows up in Attar's work, the king who can surprise you with munificent gifts, or the beloved that you try to get to but you can't, like all the different disguises of the friend, Joseph is able to inhabit all of these. So a person can be a Joseph, right, as that woman is, that princess, or every expression of desire is the Adam that is a Jacob searching for Joseph throughout eternity. So like all matter and like everything is organized around the yearning for Joseph.
Yeah, that was, I guess, the interesting thing about that for me was this mapping of romantic, erotic love between Majnun and Layli.
But all love.
But yeah, on to the paternal love, right?
For sure.
Of Jacob searching for Joseph. And that these are the same.
Yeah, that because all of them are shadows of the one.
Yeah.
Yearning and desire, right? They're all the same thing. They're all manifestations of this one thing.
And it's something that every atom, every tiniest thing, right? Not atomic theory, right? But like every atom, every smallest thing in the universe is engaged in that kind of search for something.
All matter as well as all spirit. You know, so it's truly all pervasive, right? It's not just spiritual. It's everything. It's a really weird vision of creation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as I say, very binary. I mean, that's the one thing that strikes me about it. It's unlimited in every way except for that.
So, well, what do you mean by binary there?
Well, there's always a lover and a beloved. And the roles can be mutual. That is, so for example, you know, in the story of Sheikh Saman, which we might talk about a little bit, it's one of the parables, but it's the longest one, and it's more complex than some of the others. You have a lover and beloved relation, whereas this guy, Sheikh Saman, he's in love with a Christian girl. And then later in that story, it gets reversed once he's no longer after her, she is consumed with desire for him. And they both are subsumed in ultimately desire for the divine. But it can flow one way and it can flow the other way. And the reason that's so important is, again, it's one of the many manifestations of how the love for God works, right? As the devout soul, right? You have desire for and longing for God, but that is never greater than God's longing and desire for you.
Right.
Which is why you find the divine inside yourself, because it's always already there.
Right.
And that's what I mean by binarism, because it's a drive toward unity, but it's understood through dualism, kind of.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I mean, I feel like we're getting into
I just find it interesting, almost like, I don't know, like mathematically or philosophically. Like I find the system of thought super interesting.
Right. Right. It's interesting to me that you're thinking about this as a binary, when of course, as you're saying, like the binary is being established to break it down.
Right.
Right. Like you are the beloved sometimes and you are the lover sometimes. Mm-hmm. And similarly, you may be seeking God, but God is also seeking you. And at some point, yourself will be destroyed and it will be clear that you are just part of the unity. You are God in a very real sense once you detach yourself from these identities that you seem to have.
That's right. And it's that insight that is sort of expressed in Attar's work and also more generally in the Sufi tradition through the figure of Al-Halaj, who was a Sufi mystic who gets described in Attar's work. And he says, Halaj was taken to the gallows tree and cried, "I am the truth."
Right.
They could not see the meaning of his words. and hacked at him, tearing his bleeding carcass limb from limb. And it describes his martyrdom in sort of excruciating detail. And saying, I am the truth, is understood here as kind of saying, basically saying, I'm God. And it gets understood as heretical, and that's why he's martyred, right? But for the Sufi community, it's understood as he had reached enlightenment. He had reached that moment of finding the divine where it's hidden away already inside yourself. Yeah, so by binarism, I mean that system. Like, it's driving toward unity. But I guess the reason I find that so interesting is because the Conference of the Birds makes space for something else, some overflow, some plurality in two ways, I think. Or maybe three, but two definitely. One is in the birds. You know, we're talking about the multiplicity of the birds and the fact that the birds don't have gender, right? So the birds are many that are part of one. That's going to be the Sea Morg that they are at the end, which is both Sea Morg 30 birds and also the Sea Morg one, right? So it shows up that way. But it also shows up in the Sheikh Saman story, where we're primarily thinking about Sheikh Saman and the Christian girl, but we're also thinking about his posse, you know, his people. He's got a little community around him. And that seems to be an interesting exception to the sort of relentless binarism of this text, I think.
I'm still intrigued by your sense of the binarism here, because for me, one of the things that's particularly compelling about the way this is structured is, again, something you've been saying, but it's about how things that appear as binaries in the world actually have a lot of fluidity to them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and that's one of the things that I find especially compelling about this. I mean, this is sort of like queer theory 101, I guess, but like the sense that the world is not as binary as it seems. And its answer to how you get to that is the idea of this sort of ultimate unary, ultimate oneness of everything, which I'm not as excited by, but this idea of the flow between different types of subject and object and different types of binary pairs, that this can break down or map onto other things in unexpected ways, is, I think, very compelling and moves to some of the things that I found most interesting in the text.
What were some of those parts that you found most striking?
Just that it created possibility spaces for that. And sometimes that came out most notably or most obviously in terms of the gender. So one of the characters that startled me, and I guess one whole section that startled me, involves Shebly, who I'm not familiar with other than, you know, I've first encountered him in this book, but I believe he is a historical person.
A Sufi.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's a Sufi, but he also... he went wild or something like that. I'm trying to understand exactly what his position is. But we find him in one section where one of the birds has complained about, well, it's described as, in my translation, let me see here, it's described as indecisiveness or ambivalence, I think, is in the Wolpe translation. And it's another bird, and we don't know what kind at this point in the story, but it's another bird declared, as you can see, I lack the organs of virility. Each moment I prefer a different tree. I'm drunk, devout, the world's, then briefly his. Caught between no, it isn't, yes, it is. So again, it's like this breakdown of the binary, right? The flesh will send me drinking, then I'll find the praise of God awakening in my mind. What should I do between these two extremes, imprisoned by conflicting needs and dreams? So, right, we've got this person who, we've got this bird, we've got this creature, which is constantly flicking between binary states and is caught in the slipstream between them. And the hoopoe is like, yeah, that's everyone. And then let me tell you a story about Shebly. And what is the, Wolpe has a particularly weird subheading for this one.
she calls this one The Parable of Shebly in the House of Transvestite Prostitutes.
Yeah.
I'm there for that movie.
Sure. Sure. I don't know if that's quite the phrasing I would use, but sure. No, absolutely. No.
Well, I mean, it is, this whole section is really strange, as you're saying, right? Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, we can understand, like, if we think about it allegorically, right, we can understand this experience of Shibli. He disappears. No one can find him. They find him, in Wolpe's words, in the house of transvestite prostitutes. He sits among men dressed as women. And they seek him out, and someone says, searcher of mysteries, what kind of place is this for you? And Shibli says, the people of this house are neither men nor women in whatever sins they commit in this world. I am just like them, but in the matters of faith. I am lost in my ambivalence and ashamed of wavering about who I really am. So in terms of the allegory, we're understanding people who violate the gender dynamic by wearing clothes that are not proper to them, right, in this system, right? Men dressed as women. That's how it looks like. That's a literal physical bodily manifestation of something that Shibli is experiencing in a spiritual way, right? And so it's making visible, it's making concrete, it's like enfleshing his spiritual state. And the hoopoe tells this story to the indecisive bird as a way of kind of providing a kind of, I don't know what, remedy in the form of story that will address this. And it's like hard to know how to read that section, right? Because you can give it this, I don't know what to call it, rehabilitating reading kind of where you're like, oh, it's a sort of metaphor for a spiritual state. And like, I guess. but you know, I read this, I think to myself, first I think, okay, this is the rehabilitating reading. And my second response is, I'm still kind of troubled by the way this works. And then my third response is like, well, but it's not that the text as a whole is super heteronormative in terms of how desire works, because descriptions of love, lover and beloved, are as likely to involve two men in this book as to involve a man and a woman.
Right.
So it's not as simple as that, right? So it's something complicated going on here that is at one hand very restricted and also very free at the same time. And I'm not sure how to talk about that.
Exactly. And I'm not sure even what's going on in this story. I mean, I understand that aspect of it. I understand the idea of the spiritual ambivalence. But even, you know, you get to the end of that section after Shibli has finished speaking what you read out. And by the end of it, it seems like the hoopoe is saying to the bird, you seem a Sufi to the common folk, but hide 100 idols with your cloak. If you're a eunuch underneath, don't dress in clothes of high heroic manliness. And okay, but like, does that mean just sort of embrace your ambivalence? Or does it mean, I don't know. I have no idea if this is sort of, you're not satisfying the conditions of manliness, therefore get out, or therefore own it, right? It looks like Shibli is owning it, right? Shibli is feeling ambivalent about things and therefore is hanging out in the place where the most ambivalent things he can think of are. People who are dressing and having sex in ways that are not the standard, I guess. And Shibli seems to be a role model here.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, that focus on dress in that episode goes, like, as is typically the case in this work, goes on to be sort of emphasized in the following segments, where we keep hearing about clothing and even veiling. And so there's episode 2, Sufis Go to Court, that comes shortly after that. It's about whether to wear Sufi clothing or not wear Sufi clothing. And if not, one person is told, you should wear women's veils. That would be less dishonest than your present holy dress. So what's being brought out once we get that narrative piled on top of the episode about Shibli is that clothing is often deceiving in terms of what is underneath, right? And the whole question of whether it accurately reflects what's underneath is always in play. And it's one layer that mediates between the outside world and the reality that is underneath. But it's only one of many layers, because your body is also a kind of clothing. In the story about Shibli, Shibli speaks and says, make your soul truly aware, and you'll find that whether you wear a manly beard or silky womanly locks, both are useless except as napkins to wipe your mouth. Right? It's a kind of a playful phrase, but in other words, in the same way that your clothing is this kind of superficial layer that may or may not accurately reflect the reality that's underneath, to the out and manifested to the outside world, your hair, your beard are similarly immaterial. And even, he doesn't come out and say it so much, but implicitly, even your body itself is like that.
Yeah.
Right? And so they're just layers. They're all layers. I mean, and I think, and I can see how that reading works and makes sense, but it doesn't make me feel any less weird about this story.
Yeah. No, it's true.
Right? And so, I mean, I guess what that exposes, or the reasons I find it so interesting, is that it gives us a glimpse, I think, into what's going on for 21st century readers who are separated by time, but also separated by language, by cultural formation. Like, on what ground do we approach this book? You know, it may well be that the kind of weirdness and discomfort that we find in the story of Shibli also would have been felt by the earliest readers of this text. That's totally possible. But it can also be the case that it's, for us, it's a moment that exposes these kind of fault lines between allegorical reading and, you know, the distance between the ways in which we think about embodiment and the assumptions about embodiment here. You know, I don't know. Does that strike you that way as well?
Yeah.
Like, I'm thinking about how are 21st century readers situated relative to this book? And there's a lot of different answers to that question.
Sure, as are a lot of different readers. But
yeah.
But yeah, no, I think you're right. I think it's hard to say, and it always is the trickiness when you're dealing with this particular kind of literature, I think, this sort of self-help guide, so to speak, although obviously it's destroy the self-help guide, but but where the assumptions that the text is making about you and therefore what will rhetorically work on you are quite different than what your own lived reality is, and that you as a reader might be turning to this text wanting different things out of it than what the author would have ever thought about. So my interest in this section is about the way that those gender lines are getting blurred, and I'm looking at it in a very positive way, and I'm wondering if the text is responding positively in kind, and I can't tell, and that's probably because the text isn't really interested in that question per se. And so there's a kind of stalemate. I mean, again, maybe knowing the text better, but then there's also the question of, well, okay, is the text designed, intended by the author, right, to provoke that kind of response to me, to get me to reassess gender binaries in the ways that I'm interested in reassessing them? Or is it a text that, whether it is interested in that or not, opens it up to that kind of reading? Is it a text that I can go to and see a way of thinking, that can offer me a way of thinking through these questions that are more pressing now than they might have been to most people in 1200-ish?
Yeah.
And that's the sort of, you know, availability of the new questions that new peoples have that allow for a text to continue to live on outside of its original context. But whether it's living on as itself, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really interesting response. And I can think of two, like, directions to go with that conversation. One is, you know, the story of Sheikh Saman that we were talking about a little bit earlier. That might be an interesting piece to look at a little bit more together and thinking about what is actually going on with regard to the object of desire and how that changes over time. Like, there's all kinds of neat stuff going on there. But the other thing that I'm thinking about in response to what you just said is, you know, the question of, like, readers' horizons of expectation. You know, we said earlier, and we're talking a little bit about the two translations we've been looking at and how the translation by Dick Davis and Afkam Darbandi is a bit more literary. Like, it's inviting us to think about the heroic couplet and to understand Attar's work in terms of the luxuriousness of the language, I think. I mean, not just that, but that's very much the sort of forward-facing aspect of that translation. Whereas Woolby's translation is doing something, I think, a bit different. I mean, she's a member of the, you know, Iranian diaspora. So this, to a certain extent, she's coming from and communicating with that body of people. And we could compare that with the conversations we had in the past about Satrapi's Persepolis and stuff like that. But she's also, I think, speaking to a Western, predominantly North American audience that likes to read things like Rumi or, you know, other kinds of mystical translations or adaptations from Arabic and especially Persian traditions. And, like, that's weird. I mean, I'm not, it's not bad, but, like, I'm always puzzled and interested to think about what appetite is being satisfied by those things. Like, I think especially things like Coleman Barks's translations of Rumi, which are, like, really adaptations of other translations. Like, they're often quite remote. There was a great article, I think it was in the New Yorker a few years ago, about the de-Islamification of Rumi in modern translations. And it's, you know, it's a bit, I mean, the article was great, but the fact of that is a bit, And so it's interesting to think about, like, I'm not saying this to criticize Wolpe, but the audiences that are out there for this material, they're looking for something here. And I find that interesting. You know, what is it that they're looking for, and what hunger, what spiritual hunger, I guess, is being satisfied by books like this?
Yeah. I mean, even, you know, myself, like, as I said at the top, I'm not interested in converting to, and I'm not interested in the Sufi ideal of where this book is supposed to lead me to. So what am I doing here? Well, I'm exploring this text and I'm seeing what I can gather from it and what wisdom and what pleasures and whatever else can happen when I engage with this text. Is that appropriate?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you find whatever is in your way, right? Like, you know, you don't always take away what an author or a translator or an editor is expecting you to take away, right? And sometimes you find, you know, pearls in the dust that are unexpected ones, right?
And that's also part of what this book is arguing, right? That all of our paths are going to be different, even if people who are at least attempting to attain wisdom will end up in the same end spot. The path is going to be very different. And I don't know what the field of possibility is in terms of what that end spot might look like for various people to this author. But certainly the path they admit, you know, one prays in mosques and one in idols' shrines. Mm-hmm. The person who is successfully on the path, according to this text, might be doing something completely different from what we expect. Mm-hmm. But that might still be somebody who is on the path.
Yeah. Well, that again, that comes back to, you know, I keep coming back relentlessly to the Sheikh Saman story, right? And what did you find that story interesting? I mean, because I think it really speaks to what you were just saying about the unexpected path, like the path a person might be on, which Sheikh Saman is on. And all of his people, like his community, are like, what on earth are you doing? Right? They're like horrified.
It was really interesting, and it's one of the, it's the longest story, I believe.
It is.
And it's early on in the text, and so it really did grab me. It's fascinating, and it's fascinating because, again, we've got somebody who's a very, you know, devout Muslim who falls in love and converts to Christianity.
Yeah, like converts is, like, I guess, a really nice word for him. He has this dream that he dreams over and over again, the same dream. A strange dream troubled him. Night after night, Mecca was left behind. He lived in Rome. The temple where he worshipped was his home, and to an idol he bowed down his head. Alas, he cried when he awoke. Yeah, Rome here is meant to be Constantinople. It's like the eastern capital of the Roman kingdom, so it's like not... Because in Arabic, you say home, right?
Which right, is right, right. That makes more sense.
No, I didn't. But anyway, so he has this dream, and then it kind of becomes real. He's like, I have to go to Rome. So he goes to Constantinople, and he sees a girl there, a Christian girl, and he falls in love with her. And it makes him abject, right? It's not just that he converts, right? He is kind of at her feet. Anything she asks him to do, and she asks him to do all kinds of perverse things, right? He does. He becomes the Christian slave. He puts aside everything. He drinks wine. He puts on Christian's clothing, right? And so his disciples come and try to, like, make him come away. And they have this sort of back and forth exchange, which is incredibly, it's kind of enchanting. And it's, again, in its doubleness, in its binariness, they say, cleanse yourself according to our rite. In blood I cleanse myself, the sheikh replied. Another asked, where is your rosary? He says, I fling my beads away from me. The Christian's belt is my soul sanctuary. One counseled prayer. He said, where's her face so that I may pray toward that blessed place? And it goes on back and forth and back and forth. So he's become abject from the point of view of his fellow Muslims, right? And they finally give up on this. They're like, okay, we don't know what to do with you. You've become like, you know, you're worshiping idols. That is, you know, adoring images as you would do in, you know, Christian worship, right? And this girl is your idol, right? I mean, you're just totally, we don't know what's happened to you. So they go back to Mecca. And you would think that, you almost would think that'd be the end of the story. Like, well, makes sense, guys, right? I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah, you lost one.
You lost one, right? It's the way it goes. But what happens is that there's this other friend of that community who's absolutely outraged when he hears what happened. And that's what I mean by the resistance to binarism that shows up in the Sheikh Saman story. Because the friends of Sheikh Saman are reminded that they owe something to him as well. That is, he's one of their fellows. He says this to them. He says, however hard the fight, you should have fought for what was clearly right. Truth struggled there with error. When you went, you only worsened his predicament. You've abandoned him. How could you dare to enter Mecca's uncorrupted air? And so he shames them. And then he's like, okay, we have to go. We have to go back to Rome. So they go back to Rome. And this time it's going to be different. And the reason it's going to be different is because the leader of the group, the Sheikh's true friend, has prayed and he has an ecstatic kind of vision. And again, it's a vision that's about an almost erotic kind of desire. At dawn, there came a musk-diffusing breeze, and in his heart, he knew all mysteries. He saw the prophet, lovely as the moon, whose face, truth's shadow, was the sun at noon, whose hair in two black heavy braids was curled, each hair 100 times outpriced the world. A smile of haunting beauty lit his face. Right. Anyway, and so then there's this intercession by Muhammad, and that's what's going to make it all different when they get back to the Sheikh. And it's this, it's devout, right? I mean, it's a vision of the prophet who's going to intercede, but it's in the language of the erotic language of the beloved. Right. Anyway, so they go back, and then this time Sheikh Saman is going to come with them. Truth has defeated Rome's idolatry. He came back to himself. The Sheikh was purified. His old self died. He put on the dervish cloak on as before. They set out from Mecca's gates once more. So one really cool thing that's happening there is that, like, the community's love for one another and the prophet's love for them and their love for the prophet and all of them being subsumed in their love for and belovedness by the divine, right? that all takes place. And then the story winds up with the girl now longing for Sheikh Saman. And so that's going to motivate the last part of the story. So that two-part flow of desire and love is there, but there's also this potential for multiplicity. And I think the Sheikh Saman story is the only other place that it happens in this book other than the bird frame itself. Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we had quite a lot to say about the Conference of the Birds, and I think that's been very good. I hope it was interesting for listeners to listen to. I am curious, though, it's time to check in once again. Is there anything else that you have been reading or anything else you're looking forward to reading?
More looking forward to reading than have been reading. I've just been reading bits and pieces of things, nothing substantial and meaty over the last little while. I am looking forward to reading Daniel Heath Justice's Raccoon, which is a book that's just coming out this coming month. And part of the reason for that, I mean, I love his work anyways, in general, but because I've been thinking a lot about animals, and it's not just because we're doing this cluster, I've been interested in trying to kind of get a better understanding of other ways of thinking about, this sounds like a fancy phrase for it, but like orders of creation. Like I've always been very interested in encyclopedias, like medieval encyclopedias. And so the way we think about animals and the relationship of human to animal and the sort of hierarchy of creation, like I'm very familiar with those structures of thought. But over the last couple of years, I've been reading more indigenous writers. Like remember we read Eden Robinson's Monkey Beach and thinking about the relation of the animal and the human and the ways of understanding different forms of creation. Like, so I've been curious about that. And Daniel Heath Justice's book is, I think it'd be a nice addition to that line of contemplation.
Yeah, it's coming out from Reaction Books. They're doing this whole series of books on different animals. So he has another book on this series that came out a few years ago called Badger, which I haven't read yet. I am curious about that as well, because I know he has a very special relationship with badgers. But I'm also super interested in raccoons because I live in Toronto and the raccoons are everywhere. And I am very curious about that.
I miss them.
Oh, do you?
I do. I know they're a huge pain in the neck, but they're so great. I mean, and I have all kinds of, I have raccoon stories, as every person who's lived in Toronto does, right?
I'll record them screaming some night and send that along to you. The book that I've been reading, I've poking my nose into, is a bit similar in a sense. It is by a person named Bernie Krause, who is a musician, and he specializes now in doing field recordings. And it's called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places.
Oh, wow.
And it's about, you know, he started sort of doing session work as a musician in the 60s, started getting really interested in electronic music, and then ended up doing a lot of field recording stuff and then has been evolving with that. So he's had an interesting musical life, but he also has done a lot of work about thinking about field recordings. Like traditionally, so to speak, at one point, field recordings were all about isolating a single animal.
Right.
And he really started advocating for listening to the entire spectrum of sound in a space and thinking about how animals seem to adapt in the wild so that they get their own band of frequencies. You have very high-pitched animals, very low-pitched animals, and it's designed so that they all sort of cut through the soundscape, the ambience of one particular area. And so you need to do a sort of holistic listen to everything.
That's
and
it's so neat.
It's very interesting because he's not indigenous to Turtle Island. He's not part of that tradition. He does encounter people from that tradition, but a lot of his thinking seems, to my mind at least, to be sort of coming from similar places of just wanting to respect the land and pay attention to it and learn more about it and become more deeply imbued within it and to appreciate it for a totality, for a system, for its own creatureness, for its own, I don't know. But
the relations in it. Like, in other words, you don't need to separate out one animal from the rest of the soundscape or the animate landscape, right?
Exactly. It's all about the relationality of and of the system of the whole. And he writes this in this very, I mean, it's sort of a pop science book, but it's written in this very engaged and enthusiastic manner, which I was quite enjoying.
Now, that sounds so neat. Actually, just yesterday, we have the cicadas here where I am.
Oh, yeah.
And so while I find them very creepy to look at, and I really don't like it when they land on me, like it's interesting to hear their song, right? And there's a lot of birds around here too. So it's quite a chorus. I mean, it's a polyphony company, you know? Usually I shut the windows when we record, but I feel like next time I should leave them open. You know, we have our little soundtrack.
Right? We've definitely done that before. And now that summer's coming back, we're going to get some more birdie episodes as well. All right. Well, I think we need to wrap it up there. But that is the first in our animal cluster. The next book that we're going to be looking at is a more recent novel.
Hmm.
It is Marion Engels' Canadian classic novel, Bear.
Yeah, that, I'm really looking forward to that. I took a glance at it, but I'm going to start reading it imminently. It looks, on the one hand, very much of our moment, and in other ways, very much of its own moment. It's like 50 years old now, right?
Yeah, yeah. This is a very 70s book, I'm led to believe.
Yeah. The sense I had of it, just from a quick dip into it, was both yes and no. Like, it was on the one hand very much of that moment, but there were things in it that I felt were still very present, or were present again in some ways. So that'll be neat to think about.
I am very much looking forward to that. But until then, if, listeners, you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at spouter@megaphonic.fm, or we're on Twitter at @thespouter. We would always love to hear from you. Show notes with links for anything that we've mentioned in this episode will be at megaphonic.fm/spouter/45. And The Spouter Inn is one of the fancy little podcasts over at Megaphonic FM. So, until next time.
Until next time. See you again at The Spouter Inn.